From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1988, when a 17-year-old named Heath Phillips joined the Navy. He hoped it would be the start of a career as a lifer, serving his country. At first, Heath felt comfortable with the support of several older sailors who offered mentorship. But then Phillips reported to his first post in New Jersey. He joined six shipmates for a night out in New York City, and it was a raucous night. He later woke up to the feeling of his clothes being ripped from his body. One of his shipmates was self-gratifying in his face. Now, this is hard to hear. It can be graphic at times. But this is a story that is Heath Phillips. It is also a story of sexual assault in the military that needs to be heard. And frankly, for decades, was not believed. He filed a complaint, but a senior officer told him he was a liar and a mama's boy. The officer told him he was just homesick and no one gets sexually assaulted in the military. After that first complaint, things got worse. He says he was beaten, bullied, and harassed. We'll talk about that this hour. The next decades bring a familiar and sad story of isolation, alcoholism, and pain, but Phillips found a way to turn his life in a new direction, and he's telling that story today while also telling the vital tale of sexual assault in the military. He's a guest of Nazareth College, which is hosting Phillips along with the screening of The Invisible War, a film about military sexual assault. So we've got a lot to talk about this hour. And Heath Phillips, a veteran who is with us right here in studio, nice to have you. Thank you for taking the time to come in.
Thank you. Thank you.
And also with us is Karen Vix, Nazareth College Title IX Coordinator. Karen, welcome back to the program.
Thanks.
I'm going to ask Karen just briefly to tell us what's going on this evening, because I know there's an event that you want the public to know about.
Yep. So tonight at 5:30 p.m. in the Schultz Forum at the Nazareth campus, we'll be showing a screening of The Invisible War, as you just mentioned. After the screening, Heath will give a brief story, and then we'll be having a panel. And on our panel, we'll be having Emily Labruto, who's Restore College Advocate and Education Specialist, Stacey Whitney, who's a senior forensic interviewer with Bravona Child Advocacy, and Dr. Patricia Bennett, who is a military sexual trauma counselor with the Rochester Veterans Center.
Let's just start with the story. And I began it briefly, but I want you to take us back here and kind of tell us how it started. So first of all, where did you grow up?
I'm a military brat, so I actually grew up all over the country. My last place that my father was in Indiana. Once he got out, we ended up moving here to New York. My mom is originally from Buffalo area, so it was a easy transition for my family to come back up here. Being an Army brat, that was something that I cherished as a child. I loved watching my dad shine his boots. You know, I don't know how to explain it. It's just one of them things. As a little kid, seeing it, and it made me like really proud of my father.
Something you wanted for yourself?
That was, since I can remember, that was what I wanted. I actually wanted to be a lifer in the military. When I joined, I technically joined at 16. My mom had to sign the waiver for me to get in, and unfortunately, due to my age and that I had a GED, the only military branch that would take me in 1988 was the Navy. So sitting down with my mom, sitting down with my stepfather and with my mother, I came up with the idea and the plan. I would do 4 years in the Navy. I would come out and I'd re-enlist in the Army, because technically the Army was my dream. And then I would hopefully retire out of the Army.
After how long?
I wanted to do 20 years.
Yeah. So you really had things kind of lined up in your mind and a passion for the service.
Yes. I still have a passion for the military. Yeah. Just because of what happened to me, I can't take away what the military still means to me.
Sure. So tell me about when you started out. I know you have briefly mentioned in other venues that at least in those first few days, you know, you did feel like there was some support, that there were some older folks around who were kind of offering a little bit of guidance, and you felt like, okay, we're going in a good direction here.
I'll be honest with you, I was babying boot camp. Babied in boot camp, not because of my age. I was, even though at 17, I was the only one that joined. I knew how to shine a nice polish on boots. So it kind of gained me a lot of brownie points with the rest of the people within my area. And I also knew how to stow my locker. I knew how to do the corners, you know, something that my father instilled in me and taught me when I was a child. So I brought that with me. So it kind of gave me the brownie points, the added points that you would need for somebody that was 17. And I'll be honest with you, boot camp was like one big large family. The way we all treated each other, there was no disrespect. There was nothing about ethics, nothing about age, nothing. It was, we all were one big close-knit family. And I was supposed to be an electrician technician. Unfortunately, I'm colorblind, and they didn't want their helicopters flying backwards. So they ended up sending me to a school of Marine Mississippi, ship servicemen, where basically ship servicemen's A school is you're either A, you're going to do laundry for the rest of your life, or B, you're going to work in a store. And at 17, that was not me. That was not what I wanted. And I ended up getting out, and I went home on leave and was transferred to the USS Butte AE-27, which was stationed out of Earl, New Jersey. AEs, it's an ammunition ship. So it was,
is that what you wanted? Was that a better situation for you?
It was supposed to be.
Well, sure.
They told me it was going to be a better one because basically I was going in as a boatswain's mate when I hit the ship, and then you could learn a new trade. Once you're on board the ship, you can figure out what you want and you can mold yourself into a different trade. And that was what my, you know, at 17 years old, my assumption was that's what was happening. I ended up showing up on a weekend, not realizing that even though I was following orders, I didn't have to be there until Monday. They had nobody to bring me in. And 17-year-old, that's one of the scariest situations. Being on, you know, what do you do? Where are you going to go? And a group of guys were getting ready to leave, and they're like, hey, just come hang out with us. And you can call it naive, you can call it, you know, stupid, whatever. You know, I agreed, and I went because everything that I was taught as a child, everything so far that has transitioned through the military, these guys are supposed to be, you know, my brothers in arms. They're supposed to have my back, got your six. So I never imagined the horrific incidents that happened afterwards were going to happen. There was no telltale sign. You know, there was nothing there saying this would happen.
What do you remember about that night then?
I'll be honest with you. Even though I've been in the cities, I've never been in a city at nighttime. So the saying deers, you know, their eyes are big in the headlights. Well, that's what my eyes were like. So I was really excited. Growing up as a teenager, I'm not saying we all have, but most of us have experimented with drinking and all that. So I knew kind of basically what I could drink. And when we went back to the Army and Navy hotel, they had a beer ball. And we were drinking out of little Dixie cups. You know, they're not big cups. And I remember on my second one, I just felt really weird. I can't say I was drugged because I don't know. All I know is I felt weird. Something, I just didn't feel right. And I remember sitting down on the floor, and that's all I remember until I woke up with a guy over me relieving himself in my face. And what woke me up was the feeling of, like, my pants just being pulled, like, at an aggressive feel. And, you know, I try explaining this. There's really no explaining of the feelings because the amount and rush of the feelings that went through me were just so intense. I do not even know how I got from that floor to the bathroom. I don't know how I ended up getting my pants pulled up from there, you know, from A to B. I just remember all of a sudden I'm in the bathroom, the door's locked, and I felt dirty, and I was washing my face. It felt like nothing was coming off. Even though there's nothing there, it just felt like nothing would come off. And, you know, I was upset. I was crying. I was scared, terrified. Like I said, the emotions that go through you are really hard to explain because it's really not a good word for it.
Did you have the door closed? What did you hear from the other guys?
Knocking on the door. They told me it was a joke. They're initiating me. They do this to all the new recruits. You know, just they'll leave me alone. Come on out. And I sat in the bathroom for several hours. When I did finally come out, it wasn't to hang out with them again. It was, I'm leaving. I'm going back to the ship. And the guy laughing at me saying, you're going to get lost.
So they laughed at you.
Yeah, it was funny. And then there's two of them. They had a nickname, which I didn't learn their nicknames till later on. They had nicknames of the Twin Towers. They're both 6'5", you know, really big guys. And one of the first things that one of them said was, you know, you go back and you say anything, we're going to kill you. And I'll be honest with you, I say this all the time, that killing me wasn't in my mind. It was, this is wrong. I was taught to tell you know, I'm going back and I'm telling on you. You know, this is wrong. And I made my way back to the ship, and I'll never forget meeting with the Master at Arms for the first time ever. And I'm trying to sit down, and his questioning was leading, like, everything was my fault. Were you drinking? Well, yeah, but it was, oh, but you were drinking. How old are you? Oh, well, you did wrong because you're drinking and you're 17. Are you the only kid? No, I'm not. Oh, so you're a mama's boy. Well, this doesn't happen in the military. You're a liar. But that's how he kept trying to respond to everything I was saying. And I was frustrated. I was mad. I was frustrated. I was like, why is nobody believing this? And they ended up sending me down to birthing, which birthing is really not that large. It's like a section of four rooms where there's a whole bunch of bunks in it, three bunks high, and they're kind of like, they called them coffins. And you had no room in these bunks. And I just remember all of a sudden I'm hearing voices, and all of a sudden I was scared, and I was like, oh my God, I know these voices. My attackers happened to be in the same birthing area that I resided in. And it was game on for them. I dealt with 49 days straight of being sexually assaulted. They would stick, unfortunately we're on the radio so I can't explain it, but they would stick the crooks of their fingers in the edges of my eyes, and they would push into my socket until I would open my mouth. And this was some of the things, and while they're doing this, the guy has his knee in the back of my neck, and he's pulling. You know, I've heard over the years people say, well, you should have fought back. I would have fought back. I would have done this. 49 days I reported this. 49 days I was called a liar. I at least was smart enough at 17 to know if I tried killing them, they weren't going to believe why I killed them. If they're not believing I'm being assaulted, they're not going to believe why I killed them.
Did they assault you every day for those 49 days?
Yes. And it was not just a one time in a day, you're done. No, it was, oh, look, there's Seaman Recruit Phillips. Let's go up and push him up into the thing. And some of the things, I mean, I really won't get into the graphics of everything, but some of the things they do, I mean, it was just so inhumane, the treatment that they gave to me. And it got to the point after 49 days that I went in weighing 130 pounds. I was down to 114. That's how sick I was. That's how much sleep I was not getting. I wasn't eating. Reporting this, nobody's listening. I constantly going through my mind is, why is nobody helping me? You know, they're pulling me out of my bunk. And as I said, they're three high. So, you know, you have a group of like nine people right near you. Nobody once ever stuck their head out, hey, knock it off. Don't do this. Stop. None of that ever happened. So I'm in the back storeroom. And I actually, it's kind of funny now. Then it wasn't funny, but I didn't know how to tie a noose. So I tied a sailor's knot. And I tried hanging myself. And I will attest that a sailor's knot will not choke you out. I mean, you'll hang there. It'll hurt. I wasn't high enough where the drop would snap my neck. So I dangled there, and I sat there for a long time. And a chief petty officer comes in, and I'll never forget him helping me get down and smacking me in my face and saying, listen, you need to man up. You need to make them stop. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, if you know, why aren't you helping me? And I was at that point, I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. And I went and I walked off the ship. I went down to the end of the pier, and I called home. And I talked to my mom a little bit. I never really told my family at first really what was happening. And then I called my father. And my father, being a lifer himself, said something to me that really shocked me. He was like, come home. And still today, this still baffles me on why my father would say something like that. You know, I mean, I know he cared enough, but, you know, he was such a pro-military person that it was like, oh my God, my dad's telling me
to come home. He technically wanted you to go AWOL.
Yes. And I went home, and the following day of getting home, my father took me to Griffiths Air Force Base, which at the time was still an Air Force base. And I met with Congressman Sherwood Bullard, and he sent my father out of the room after, you know, we discussed some things, and I couldn't really share with him what was happening. Just all I remember telling him is, you know, I was being sexually touched and things done wrong that weren't supposed to be happening to me. And he's like, listen, we're alone. This is off the record. Don't go back. I'm doing an investigation. You know, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. This is not right. And, you know, it was funny because I remember that play his days him saying this to me. And so I go home, and my mom and dad are no longer together. I got a stepfather who also was ex-military. He was in the Army as well. And so I'm at their house, and I just remember state troopers. I was home like a week. State troopers were knocking at the door like 4 or 5 times a day. And, you know, my parents are at work, so I'm like, oh, my gosh. And then when my mom was home, she, you know, God bless my mother, she lied and said, you know, he's not here. And so I ended up going living in the streets in Cortland, which it's not really that huge of a city or town or whatever you want to call it. But it was actually this time of the year in 1988, and it was cold, and I lived on the streets. I ended up getting in trouble. I was stealing hot dogs out of a store, and something that I had learned, you can eat hot dogs and bologna raw, and the meat's not going to bother you raw. So I ended up getting arrested, and I met with a forensic scientist, a mental health provider at the jail, and I sat at the jail for a little over 60 days trying to, you know, take care of everything, because being in the military, things were a little bit harder to do anything with me on. And I met with this lady 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And I finally got comfortable enough to where I shared some of the details with her. You know, I really didn't go into details, but I shared some with her. And she made me write to my mom. It's kind of weird. I forgot about it for many, many years. But she made me write to my mom and explain a little bit to what happened to me, to my mom, to, as she called it, to open up the door to try healing. And shortly after I did the letter, my things were over with, and I was ended up picked up by the military police. They took me to the Brig, which is the Navy prison in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I got there, so I was got there like mid-afternoon. You leave, you're in a big dorm, and you leave, and you go down, and you have chow, and you come back. And then the very next day, we're having breakfast, and I'll never forget somebody yelling my name. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, who knows my name? And then they yelled it again, and I'm like, oh, my God, I know this voice. And I remember turning and looking, and I'll be honest, I almost peed myself. That's how scared I was. The guys that I called the Twin Towers were there. They were in the Brig. And they were pointing at me, talking to each other, pointing, and kept yelling at my name. And I'm like, oh, my God, why are they here? I didn't know why they were there. And I didn't eat breakfast. You know, I was too shook up. But I remember going back, and they called me down and did, like, an intake with me where I met with a lieutenant and this to find out, you know, why I was AWOL, you know, why am I here. And I told the guys, listen, I went AWOL. In fact, 2 of my assaulters are here, and I gave their names. And before lunch even hit, I was released from the Navy Brig. And I was sent to, they call it the temporary personnel unit, and to await for my ship to come pick me up. And I never knew why these 2 guys were there until many, many years later when, you know, my sober life came about. But they sent me back to the ship, and it was really weird. I get back to the ship, and the XO meets me, and he's like, we know what's going on. We got rid of everybody. You know, you don't have to worry about it. So I'm thinking, you know, all 6 guys are gone. I get back down to berthing. Not 6 were gone, only 3 were gone. And I found out many years later the 3rd guy that was missing was not in the Brig. What they did is they sent him to Pensacola, Florida. And I was reading the investigation that the congressman did. And in the investigation, this guy had been accused of this same behavior at a prior duty station. And that's why they shipped him away. But then in the same paper, I was mistaken due to the guy's feminine behavior and due to my age. But yet he's been accused of this before. You know, it's just, it made no sense. But when I first came back, the probably first 7 to 10 days, there was no issues. You know, people would not talk to me. I was known as the rat, and I didn't know why I was known as the rat. You know, I didn't put 2 and 2 together that, you know, the congressional investigation did things. And then things, when they first started back attacking me, it wasn't like sexual. It was more violent, beating me up. they'd take me out to the fantail and hang me over the back of the ship, you know, and threaten to drop me in. And, you know, I would report these things. They would urinate in my clothes. They would feces in my bed, shoes, any, you know, it was gross. And this kept going on and on, and I kept reporting it, and I kept getting the same thing. This is not happening. Why are you doing this to yourself? That was my favorite. Why are you doing this to yourself? I said, yeah, I'm really, you know, putting my own poop in my boots. Okay. It made no sense to me.
So you felt like you were back in a situation where no one believed you?
Yes. And things started escalating, and these guys started back to the sexual. It was like a game with them. I tried telling people it was like a game because you knew they were coming because they were laughing. Let's go get Phillips. I'm like, oh, God. And you can't hide. Where are you going to hide? You're on a ship. And, you know, I tried telling people, listen, I fought back. And if I fought back, the more I fought back, the more violent they assaulted me. And it was just, you know, I didn't just lay there and take it, but it was like these guys were not nice people. You know, it was all just dominating me. And so I got to the point, my ship would leave. It would, like, go on a weekend excursion down to Virginia or something. So I would go AWOL, unauthorized absence is what they called it in the Navy. And I would still be on base. I would just wait for my ship to leave, and I'd turn myself in. My ship would come back, and I'd report back to the ship. And I was not getting in trouble for this. And it came to the point that these guys decided that the worst game, worst thing that they could ever do. So I'm showering, and they pull me out of the shower, and I'm trying to fight back, and it's kind of hard. You're naked. I still only weighed like 120 pounds. So they get me down to the ground, and they're repeatedly kicking me. And then there's a guy, he got on my back, and he kept banging the side of my head against the floor, the deck. Just kept banging it and banging it. And I remember always seeing like these bright star lights, you know, flashing. And then he stopped hitting me, but he still had my head pinned, and he had his knee right in the crook of my neck. And I just remember I couldn't move. You know, I can move my feet, but I just couldn't move. And I heard one of the guys saying something about shoving this inside him. And they tried sodomizing me with my shampoo bottle. And then the guy basically said that he was going to rape me. And you felt the pressure. You felt the feeling of a guy getting on top of you. And then nothing. I didn't feel anything. I just felt his body weight. And then he got up and he started kicking me. And apparently he couldn't get himself aroused, and he was mad. So he ended up walking away. And then a few minutes later, one of the worst pains still to the day, I felt like my insides were being ripped out by a hot branding iron. It hurt. And it was so bad that I passed out from it. And when I came to...
What did he use? What did they use to sodomize you there?
A toilet brush.
A toilet brush.
Yes. They left it inside me, actually. That's when I came to, I reached back there and it was still there. And I was covered in blood and feces and urine. And, you know, you're on a tiled floor, so, you know, it's like, you know what you're in. And I just remember, I was looking up, and there's a guy brushing his teeth, and he's looking at me, and I'm thinking to myself, God, please help me up. You know, I couldn't say it because nothing could come out. And I'm just like, in my head, God, please help me get up. And he wouldn't help me, and I ended up getting up. And, you know, my vision went to like a little pin vision. I don't know how to explain it besides, you know, like everything was just a circle in front of me. I walked all the way through my ship naked, covered in all this stuff with this toilet brush in my hand, all the way to medical because I was bleeding. And, you know, I didn't know what to do. I get to medical. The guy's face was I just was in shock. And he asked me to lean over the examining table. I remember leaning over, and he never put gloves on. He never touched me. He never did anything except for telling me, oh, well, I know what it is. You have a ruptured hemorrhoid. I'm like, no. These guys just did this to me. And he's like, no, they didn't do that. You have a ruptured hemorrhoid. That's what I'm writing down. If, in fact, you can have tomorrow off. And I'm like, this is a, you know, what? I was confused and I was mad. I remember standing up and grabbing this thing and just walking out while he's trying to tell me not to walk out. And I walked all the way down to the Master at Arms office. I didn't knock. I just walked in. And I didn't even get any words out. He's already had his hand up in the air going, whoa, 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 whoa. I've already talked to medical. I don't know why you're here. Nothing happened to you. And it's kind of weird. It's like my eyes felt really funny. And I remember the feeling of like anger and this red, like he turned red. And I threw the toilet brush at him. Today it's funny, but then it wasn't. And I said a lot of rotten choice words to him. And I turned around, I walked out. I walked all the way back to Berthie and I cleaned myself off. I got dressed and I went UA again. I went AWOL. And I stayed on, it was funny because I stayed on base. And about 3 or 4 weeks later, the ship left and it went on a Mediterranean cruise. And I turned myself in. And instead of getting in trouble, they ended up giving me orders to fly me back to my ship. They sent me back. I ended up catching my ship probably about a month later. And I was never in trouble, you know, never handcuffed. So, you know, this whole time I'm like on orders. And I meet my ship in Marseille, France. And I'll never forget going across the gangplank. And then, like, they had me stand there, and the guy got in this little intercom thing. And then the XO came down with two petty officers. And he's like, Seaman Group Phillips, our hands are tied. We weren't going to get you in trouble, but since you missed ship's movement for the fleet, Fleet Command is requesting that you get court-martialed. But don't worry, we got you. And I'm like, what do you mean you got me? You know, I'm 18. I didn't know what was going on. And he says, well, we're going to request that you get 6 months confinement to the ship. And that's all that will happen to you. You know, everything that's going on, we think we're helping you. And I'm like, what do you mean 6 months to the ship? And he's like, you can't leave. And I'm like, oh, no, I'm not doing that. And as soon as I said that, I was handcuffed. And from being handcuffed, I was escorted to a storage room. Sat in a storage room, I don't even know how many days. And I was lucky when I got food. And it wasn't like a real meal. It was like a sandwich or something stupid. No toilet paper, with a bucket to urinate and do my number two in. And I was like, oh, okay, good. I'm not with these guys. I mean, that was what my mindset was.
At least you're not with the attackers.
Yeah, I was like, glad I'm in a storeroom because I'm not with these guys. And they came, the same two petty officers came and got me, and they handcuffed and shackled me and escorted me over to one of the carriers. And still today, I don't even remember what carrier it was. And I'll never forget, though, they shackled me and handcuffed me to the deck. So I was, like, pinned down in a, not a fetal position, but, you know, standing fetal position to the deck. I was there for what felt like a long time. I couldn't tell you how long, but for, you know, me sitting there, it felt like a long time. And I'll see my attorney coming in, and it was so funny because he's, like, walking at me, and he turns and looks at them, and he's like, I thought this guy's only here for ship moving, ship, you know, missing ship movements. You know, is this my right guy? Why is he like this? And he yelled at them because they had me shackled and handcuffed like that. And so we sit down. He had him go get me a table and a chair. So we're sitting down and we're talking. And I actually, you know, everything blurted right out to this guy because, you know, I had enough. And he says, I'm not going to have you let you go back to your ship. We're going to make it so you get stuck here, so you'll have, be over here while this is all going on. I'm like, you know, thanking God. And it took about, I want to say about 10 days of litigation between him and command and the fleet. And he came back to me and he's like, listen, we got two different choices. I've tried getting you transferred. They won't transfer you. So either A, you take this, or B, they're offering you an other than honorable discharge if you sign paperwork. No court-martial, none of that, and you'll be right out. You know, as soon as you sign it, within 24 hours, you'll be gone. And I was like, oh, God. And I was to the point, I don't care. I would have signed my death certificate, deal with the devil. It didn't matter what I was signing. As long as I was not going back on that ship, I was signing it. And so I took that deal. And
other than honorable discharge.
And other than honorable discharge. And I'll be honest with you, I'm 18. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know the stigma behind it. I didn't know what a bad paper carries in the real world. So, you know, I went home 18. I'm already an alcoholic because, you know, everything that was happening, I drank continually. And I went home and I couldn't keep a job. I couldn't be near men. I had issues. I love masonry work and I tried doing that a lot. And you'd get up on a wall and you're doing bricks or blocks and somebody would make a snide comment or something, just a stupid comment, and it would trigger me. And I'm like, oh, I can't do this. And, you know, for years I went through drunk. I got in trouble with DWI. You know, I wrote bad checks to drink. You know, I did stupid things just so I didn't have to, like, live in real life. I don't know if that makes any sense, but.
Can I jump in here for one second? Because what we're going to do now is we're going to get our only break of the hour. And when we come back, this really horrific tale that he's telling finally takes a turn. But it took another sort of a near-death night in 2009. We're going to talk about that with Heath Phillips coming up. And we're going to talk about what finally changed for him earlier this year, right?
Yes.
So what finally changed earlier this year. And then before the hour's out, you know, you're hearing a story of military sexual assault from Heath Phillips, who in 1988, at the age of 17, joined the Navy with the goal of being in the Navy for 4 years and then Army for 20. And this was a very different time. Certainly not no one, but very few people compared to today were talking about sexual assault in the military or sexual assault in believing survivors. We're going to talk to him about how he sees what is changing as well. So let's get that only break and we'll come right back on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. The reason that Heath Phillips, who is a veteran who is telling his story of military sexual assault, is in Rochester today is because Nazareth College has not only brought in Heath Phillips, but has an event tonight. And I want Karen Vicks, who is the Title IX coordinator at NAS, to tell us what's coming up tonight. Go ahead.
Sure. So again, tonight we'll be showing The Invisible War, which is a film that takes an in-depth look into sexual assault in the military through personal stories of victims and highlights personal and social costs of the assault. So that will be the film in the focus. And then after the film, Heath is going to speak and share his story with the campus. And then we do have a panel discussion afterwards.
What time does everything start tonight?
5:30.
And where is it?
It's in the Schultz Forum. On the NAS campus.
Okay, and what's the cost to go?
It is free.
Free and open to the public. 5:30 tonight, The Invisible War, the film, and then the talk by Heath Phillips and the conversation with the panel. And so you end up, and I think your story becomes, this is where it's sadly familiar with people who were victimized in these kind of ways. You become an alcoholic. As you said, you had trouble holding a job. You would have moments where you felt triggered because of something that was said or something that was done. And then finally something happens in 2009 that kind of turns things a little bit, turn things a lot. What happened in 2009?
February 3rd, driving home, it's actually February 4th, but I was so intoxicated. I was at the lowest part that life could actually be at. I was driving, I had no seatbelt on, and my mindset was I wanted to die. I was ashamed of myself. I was embarrassed by my life. I was embarrassed to be a father. And you know, all these things just kept rolling in that just played a lot of keys on why I felt so bad. And a road that I've driven all my life, I was so drunk. It was like that one-eye drunk. Because two eyes, there's too many roads. One eye, at least, there's three roads, and I could tell which one to be on. And I just remember wanting to hit a tree. I just wanted to hit a tree. I wanted to die. And
so you're looking for a tree to hit.
Yes. And, you know, I thank God today that somehow from that mindset of where I was to when I came to the next morning, it was, I blacked out, so I didn't hit that tree. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, see, this is the part of the story that I've heard you tell that I don't fully understand. So you remember wanting to hit a tree and just end it all. And then all of a sudden it's the next morning. You blacked out while you were driving, or you just don't really remember?
I say I blacked out I don't remember. I just remember where I was at when I was really thinking this, and I had taken my seatbelt off, and I was just so angry, and I was really driving very fast for the conditions. And it was just, I'm dying. I'm going to hit a tree. I want to die. To, I'm opening up my eyes and I'm in my truck and it's still running and I'm in my driveway going, oh my God, how'd I get here? What happened? And I'll be honest with you, when I first opened my eyes, I'm like, is this what death looks like? You know, that was what was in my head. And it was like all of a sudden a trigger, this big neon light came on over my head. And I'm like, oh my God, I don't want to be like this anymore. I can't do this. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, and I cried. I 20 years worth of crying I did that day. And it wasn't just, you know, boo-hoo. It was like sobbing and drooling and the snot coming out. You know, I was
crying.
It's a good
cry, man, huh?
Yeah.
You said you really hadn't cried in 20 years.
Yeah.
That's a lot pent up.
Yeah. And, you know, I went in the house and, you know, what was going through my mind is I don't want to live like this. You know, I want to be a dad. I want to be somebody. I don't like this life. And, you know, I was dumping out all my, it was weird because I was dumping out all my alcohol. I mean, everything's just dumping. And I took pain pills to help me sleep and I'm flushing them down the toilet. And I smoked cigarettes. I even threw all my cigarettes away. And, you know, I tell people, you know, I didn't do AA. I didn't do any of them programs. My AA is before I blacked out that memory of wanting to die and hit a tree. I don't want to be there again. I don't want that life. And I would not wish that life, even on the guys that assaulted me, I would not wish that life too. It was a bad life. And I feel that when that light bulb came on, there was a reason. And there was.
And so you stopped drinking?
Yes.
And you started looking for a way to maybe change your life and get the status changed on your other than honorable discharge, and it took some time.
Yes.
Take me through that a little bit.
So originally I filed once before in 2003 and everything was denied. And I was a drunk back then, so really I didn't pursue anything. So I wanted to get help. That was my biggest thing, is I knew I needed help. And so I filed to be what they call service-connected for post-traumatic stress disorder, and I tried to get my discharge upgraded. So it took me from 2009 to 2015 before the Veterans Administration said, yeah, we'll overlook your discharge because, you know, you have severe PTSD. And I won that on an appeal in 2015, and it's one of the rarest cases that is like one in a million that ever happens. And I still was being denied an upgrade. And so I became very determined, and I did a lot of, from 2010 to this year, I did a lot of things in Washington, D.C. on legislation to help mm-hmm. sexual assault survivors, women's health issues. Things that all pertain to sexual assault, I put my hands into to try figuring out ways to help people. And I helped with a bill called the Fairness for Veterans Act of 2016, which is a bill that was designed to help technically the Vietnam era for the ones that have post-traumatic stress disorder that had bad paper discharges to be able to bring their paperwork in and have it reviewed to possibly get an upgrade. And Senator Kirsten Gillibrand's office connected me with an attorney's out of New York City, the Urban Justice Center, and they took my case pro bono. And this is a law firm that, you know, they tailored a high-end clientele. And they filed my paperwork, and I won't lie, my file, they got affidavits. They found my lawyer. They found the master at arms. They found all six of my attackers. They found people on board the ship. I mean, they built a really solid case, and I'll never forget. So, May 30th, sitting home, I was barbecuing, and I get a phone call, and it's not a number I recognize, so I didn't take it. And I said, "Oh, it left me a message." So I put it like an hour afterwards, because, you know, I was cooking. And it was my lawyer. She was like, "Hey, you need to call me ASAP on this thing. And I'm like, oh, yeah, we got denied. So I called her, and she's like, hey, Heath. I'm like, yeah, hey, what's up, Coco? She goes, are you sitting? I'm like, no, go ahead and tell me. I already know I got, you know, denied. And she started crying. I'm like, oh, my God, why are you crying, Coco? She goes, you won. She goes, not only did you win, you got the best honorable discharge code possible, meaning that you can reenlist if you wanted. And I'm like, what? And I sat. And then I cried. You know, it was a very emotional thing because not only did they give me that upgrade, they also basically apologized and admitted that I really was assaulted while I served. And that was why they gave me such a great discharge. And I won't lie, a few weeks later, I tried to join the National Guard, and apparently I'm a dinosaur, so I couldn't join. But see, that's what my love for the military, you know, I never lost my love for the military. I speak at military installations all over the United States. What I lost is how they've made sexual assault political. You know, I understand that you have to have politics in place.
But tell me more about what you mean by that. How has it become political?
Like with the military, we have to pass a law for them to do the right thing. You know, no, you don't. They have the SHARP programs. When my philosophy is, when you get too politically involved into issues, it kind of waters down the effects. That, you know, they're trying to do this Military Justice Improvement Act, which, you know, I'm on military bases a lot. I see the big difference from when I was in 1988 to, you know, 2018. There's a big difference. Yeah, it still happens. Yes, you know, I don't ever see it ever in my lifetime ever stopping happening in the military or anywhere. But there's more safeguards in place. There's better resources. There's no resource for me. My resource was being called a liar. Now you have these SHARP programs where you have not only civilians but military working hand in hand trying to ensure that this doesn't happen.
Your father believed you, didn't he?
Yes.
I mean, you say you had no resources, and I understand the point. I wonder how important it was to you that your dad, a military lifer himself, believed you.
You know, I don't share this that often, but when I first came home, I blamed my dad and I blamed my mom. That was just the sick part of my head with the PTSD. It took me to become sober to actually build a relationship with both my parents. But my father and I are very, very tight now. I was an a-hole for a while, you know, I won't deny it. But I think the last, I want to say 5 years, I have done more with my father than I probably had in 20 years. And when you hear, hey, I'm proud of you, son, and things like that, it, you know, does choke me up. So, you know, I'm proud of him because he's as much of an a-hole as his son was, he still stuck up with me.
He believed you when... And here's the thing. It seemed pretty clear from your story and that it's not that they didn't believe you on the ship. It's that they chose to do nothing.
Yeah.
Because you had people eventually... The day that you tried to end your life with the sailor's knot, the person who found you said, you got to stand up to these guys. And as you said, that was an alarm bell that went off in your head. They know what's happening. They're just telling you, hey, suck it up, man. Or man up. That's the phrase.
That was my favorite phrase.
That's the phrase that just kind of drives me nuts. And how many times did you hear that over the years? You're being sexually assaulted repeatedly, sodomized, and you're told, man up.
That was actually a trigger for a lot of years.
When you would hear that elsewhere?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. To me, it's not manning up. It's, hey, why aren't you guys manning up? I think that was what my biggest issue is, and I still have a hard time with that today, knowing that nobody on the ship had my back. You know, they weren't my family. They were scared to be anything. And the military calls that bystander intervention. To me, I just call it doing the right thing. So, yes, it's trigger.
Let me read an email I just got from a listener named Rachel who says, listening to this heartbreaking tale, listening to this is heartbreaking, not only for the abuse Mr. Phillips was forced to endure. Hearing about the leadership who completely ignored the trauma, they are every bit as complicit as his attackers. Each and every one of those people should be court-martialed, fined to help repay Mr. Phillips, and imprisoned, as hard as it is for him to relive this. Thanks to him so much for sharing the story. People should know, and glad that there is finally some light at the end of this tunnel. That's from Rachel.
Thank you, Rachel.
What happened to the people involved in your story?
So the two guys that I told you that were in the brig, the quote-unquote Twin Towers, they actually were in the brig for assaulting 17 other shipmates while I was gone. The investigation, they sent an NIS agent on board the ship who compiled all this on these two. Mm-hmm. And the command shipped that one guy away. And one of the other three is a registered sex offender in New Jersey. The captain of my ship was forced to retire. I want to say it was 1994 or 91. Something to do with prostitutes over in Korea.
Okay.
And he publicly said something wrong.
Okay.
And my attorney is still in Washington, D.C., still works for the military. My lovely master at arms lives in Syracuse, New York. I threw away his address just so there was no chance of me wanting to meet him. It's like everybody faces that, like the two guys that got court martialed, they got 60 days in bad discharges. I mean,
so very little consequences.
Yes.
So in our last couple of minutes, let me just ask you about what you feel the public should hear about believing victims. We hear believe victims. We often hear the phrase believe women, because women more often than men are sexually assaulted.
Correct.
But obviously not entirely one side or the other. And I always feel like the best thing we can do is to take survivors or take claims seriously. And that means listen, respect, investigate as much as we possibly can to show that respect. And when we find something, do something about it. That to me is even better than the notion of believe. And I'm not saying don't believe. Mm-hmm. I'm saying respect, listen, investigate. What do you want people to do?
Listen. Mm-hmm. A victim or a survivor, it's one of the things, nobody listens until it's too late. And I think if somebody's just willing to listen, I mean, you don't have to validate, you don't have to agree with the person, but at least listen to what they have to say and let them get that initial, this is what happened to me out. And believe it or not, that actually helps the victim to be able to learn how to start to heal, is by getting it out. Respect, you're correct. A lot of survivors are not respected or considered weak, or it's a taboo subject, or mm-hmm. just doesn't happen to men, or, oh, well, you're too drunk. A rape is rape. It doesn't matter if you're male, female, or child, you know, it's a crime.
And in our last 45 seconds, how's life now? Do you see are you optimistic about your future now?
I'm still moving forward. I do everything one step at a time. I try to surround myself with positive people, and I try to do everything I can positive to help others.
Do you think the military is going to change its culture? Because you're right. I mean, legislation could be pushed through, but you also are correct in pointing out that if there's a tinge of politics, it makes things a little stickier. How do you see it?
I have seen a lot of change in the military.
That's good.
I think, unfortunately, things take time.
Yeah.
Well, I think that the culture change is changing. It's shifting.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And I wish you well. I think Rachel's email is emblematic of how a lot of people certainly received your story today. And you've got a chance to hear Heath Phillips tonight. So tonight, Nazareth College is showing a film called The Invisible War. It's from an Oscar and Emmy-nominated director. And it is a film about sexual assault in the military. That's at 5:30 tonight, free, open to the public in the Schultz Center Forum on the NAS campus, followed by a talk by Heath Phillips, the veteran you heard today, and following that, a panel discussion. Karen Vicks from NAS, thanks for putting this together. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Heath, again, best luck on your travels, and here's to a bright future for you.
Thank you.
Short break, more Connections coming up.